The kids locked up in our juvenile prisons are overwhelmingly poor and black and brown. They're not getting rehabilitated. They're getting abused.
So when you talk about things like strip searches and pat-downs, they are often re-traumatizing, whether or not the guards push it or harass them as they do it. And a strip search isn't what we think. A pregnant girl describes having to crouch and cough, lift her breasts. It's very invasive. And it happens all the time. I mean, I remember once I went to teach a writing workshop inside a juvenile hall and didn't know that I was supposed to count the pencils before I handed them out so that I could count them again to make sure that no one had taken one. And because I made that error, every kid who'd been in my class had to be strip searched. I was the one who blew it, but they were the ones who were paying the price. And that's one of many incidents that brought home to me the way that these kids feel really like they're paying not so much for what they've done, but for who they are.
And who they are is overwhelmingly kids of color and poor.
That's right.
That's Nell Bernstein. We talk with her today about juvenile prison, what it's doing to kids, and what to do about it. We spend the hour with Nell Bernstein today talking about her book, Burning Down the House. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. The murder of Michael Brown by policeman Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, has shone a spotlight on the terrible jeopardy this society puts young black men in. They're treated as dangerous predators by law enforcement, subject, as we've seen in case after case, to the threat of summary execution. But the problem goes far beyond out-of-control police officers. Young people of color, both boys and girls, are too often assumed to be guilty of criminal behavior and deserving of severe punishment by the juvenile criminal justice system. Fully one-third of children in America are arrested before they reach the age of 23. Most of them are children of color. A black child is 5 times as likely to be incarcerated for the same offense as a white child. Once arrested, often for so-called crimes as minor as bringing an Advil to school or sassing a teacher, they face incarceration in youth prisons where serious physical and sexual abuse is the norm, beatings like those revealed at Rikers Island in New York, and rapes. And that abuse is mostly perpetrated not by their fellow inmates, but by the adults who are supposed to be guarding them and keeping them safe. Prison policies not only allow this abuse to go on with impunity, they institutionalize brutality. Many kids are locked up in solitary confinement for months, a form of torture that breaks down their mental stability and leaves lasting scars. This horrendous reality is the subject of Nell Bernstein's searing exposé, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. The book tells the stories of the kids she met, kids denied basic human rights to safety, health, and an education. She shows the way the juvenile criminal justice system is treating these kids not only doesn't help them, it makes us less safe. And it costs a bundle, $88,000 a year on average to lock up a kid. California, for example, spends around $225,000 a year and only $8,000 on educating a student in public school. It doesn't have to be this way. Nell Bernstein says we need to take the focus off punishment and put it on true rehabilitation. She says the very act of isolating these kids in prisons denies delinquent children the thing that is most essential to their growth, positive relationships with caring adults. Nell Bernstein's previous book, All Alone in the World, was about the children of the incarcerated. She is a former Soros Justice Media Fellow and winner of a White House Champion of Change Award. Her articles have appeared in Newsday, Salon, Mother Jones, and The Washington Post, among other publications. Burning Down the House is out from New Press.
Nell Bernstein, welcome to Writer's Voice. This amazing book, burning down the house. It's beautifully written, powerfully written. I want to ask you, how did you get involved in the issue of juvenile prisons?
You know, it sort of came to me because I've been involved with teenagers just about since I stopped being one. I volunteered in a runaway shelter during college, and probably as a result of that, worked in a group home afterwards. And then after that, I was the editor of a youth newspaper in San Francisco for about 10 years. And that was during the 1990s, which was the height of the super predator propaganda and the fear of youth. So really, I got involved just because my staff were getting arrested, and I would go with them to court, and if that wasn't effective, would visit them while they were locked up, and just saw what a big presence these institutions were in young people's lives.
And you were working on a youth newspaper. Tell us a little bit about that.
It was called Yo, Youth Outlook, and it was produced by Pacific News Service, which is now New America Media. And it was at a time when there were budget cuts in the schools, and it looked like a lot of the schools were going to be losing their journalism programs. So it was part of a larger journalism organization. And I think what made us unique was we had the widest open door you could imagine. You know, we had suburban valedictorians and eighth grade dropouts and just kids from every neighborhood, which created and also working side by side with UC Berkeley professors and professional journalists. So it created a really lively conversational dynamic, to put it mildly. But it also created some conflict because our offices were in the financial district, and many of our staff were coming from, you know, what you would call inner city neighborhoods, although in San Francisco they tend to be outlying. And especially as the super predator hype built, to get to work, they had to deal with purse clutching and street crossing and, you know, car doors locking and people shrinking to the walls of the elevator. I mean, it got to the point where one of my staff had a T-shirt made to get to work that said, "No, white lady, I don't want your purse." And the really sad thing about that is it actually helped.
Yeah, I mean, people actually took him seriously and visibly relaxed.
Yeah, yeah, I thought it might be a laugh line, but no. And to me, what that demonstrated was how profound the lack of communication was between, you know, the kids who were working for us and the rest of the world, that a statement that literal and straightforward was actually taken as just communication, perhaps the only communication that the quote-unquote purse clutchers had had with the folks they were afraid of. And I think that that was part of what gave me such a drive to help get these voices out there, because we fear what we don't know. And, you know, we don't know a lot of our kids.
Yeah, and this is really, I mean, a book of profound compassion and outrage, and also about telling the truth. And you start out with a young man named Jared, who told you to just write the truth. And he was a kid on a mission. I mean, he felt like time was running out. Tell us about Jared, and then tell us, kind of boiled down, what is the truth that you seek to tell in this book?
Okay, well, those are big questions. And, you know, the funny thing is, he wasn't a kid when he sent me the text that you're talking about. He was probably 40 years old, but still, and I'd known him for 20 of those 40 years, but so haunted by his past that he still felt that urgency. You know, and he was the kid from whom I learned most personally that the only thing that rehabilitates kids is relationship. And he taught me that lesson in a very difficult way. He was just a few weeks out of San Quentin when he joined our staff. He had been adjudicated as an adult when he was 15 or 16. And he was very quiet, reserved, but a tremendous writer. So most of our interactions were writer-editor. except one interaction. He came into the office one afternoon pretty visibly drunk and pointed a gun at my head. And I don't think I'd ever seen a handgun before. And I was terrified, not so much in the moment. I think I was kind of in shock. But he left, and afterwards, I just could not get rid of the fear. And I don't think I wanted him locked up. He had two strikes, and I knew that that would mean he would go away for life. But I did want him gone. I felt like I would never be safe unless I could be certain that he was, that I wasn't going to encounter him again. And that created a lot of conflict with our mutual employer, who had actually taken him into her home. And, you know, he really was becoming part of her family. And I took that as sort of a betrayal. And I remember, you know, thinking about that 20 years later when he and I were together at her husband's funeral. He had died of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, which is just a really horrific combination. And it had been Jared who had been a main caregiver to him, had bathed him and fed him and literally carried him, caught him when he fell. And we were at a memorial, a small private memorial in the woods. And I was watching Jared, and my own son, who was 6 or 7, was showing him his magic tricks and was really almost in his lap. And I was just kind of smiling at the pretty scene. And then I remembered how afraid I'd been of him, and I realized how wrong I had been to want our employer to sever that relationship and to think that that would make me safer. Because really, what made me feel so safe that I trusted him with my child was that very relationship. And it was that long-term relationship that was unconditional, that had turned him around in a way that made me and the rest of us safe. And that's something that incarceration just doesn't do.
Exactly. And that, you know, if anything is a theme of your book, it's that relationship is what is destroyed in this juvenile, so-called justice, I would call juvenile injustice system. You also talk about Curtis. So Jared was older. Curtis was a 10-year-old kid when he first went into the California Youth Authority. Tell us a little bit about his story, and tell us what a child like Curtis can expect when he's locked up in juvie. How do the bonds of relationship get destroyed?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to make a technical distinction. The book really focuses not on what we think of when we say juvie, which is like local county juvenile halls, but on state juvenile facilities. I call them prisons because that's what I saw them to be. They're actually called academies or boys' schools or sometimes facilities. So that's what I'm looking at. And that's where Curtis was sent at 10, not to a juvenile hall, but to the place where the big boys go. There were young men there who were 24, I think even 25 years old. So he was terrified and dealt with his terror the way I think that many young people do, which is by lashing out before he could be victimized. And as a result of that, as a result of his effort to prove that he was a fighter and couldn't be messed with, he ended up spending months at a stretch in solitary confinement. And, you know, I have kids who are 13-year-old twins now, but they were 10 when I started writing this book. And the notion of locking a child that age up in an environment where, as he put it, his only human contact was the nurse who pushed the medication cart down the hall twice a day. It's not just personally appalling to me. It's been pretty widely established that that kind of extended solitary confinement drives even healthy adults literally crazy. And, you know, and similarly, I've talked a lot now about my own experiences, but it's also been demonstrated that incarceration itself is the greatest predictor that a young person will end up as an adult prisoner. You know, in fact, 80 to 90% of all American teenagers in confidential interviews acknowledge having done something or a number of things that could have gotten them locked up. But most of us just kind of grow up and grow out of it. It's those who don't get that chance who wind up caught in a cycle of criminality.
And Curtis, I mean, I don't remember exactly, but my impression is that it was not a major violent crime that sent him into the system to begin with. You say even most kids are really doing minor crimes, and yet they're being sent to solitary. What landed him in the system? And then also tell us what happened to him. What happened to his psyche? What happened to his brain after a year in solitary?
Well, he started out his so-called criminal career doing things like overturning chairs in school. And he had a very traumatic family life and was expressing his loneliness and his rage. But, where he might have been, put on Ritalin or given counseling in a white middle-class school, in the neighborhood where he lived, the police were the frontline intervention when he acted out in that way. And, I think he stabbed a teacher with a pencil. And it was that, or perhaps a robbery, that ended him up in the state juvenile system. But that is, I think, a really commonly held misconception, that once you're behind that razor wire and wearing that uniform, you're a murderer or, at best, a carjacker. But the truth is that even in these higher-end facilities, 60% of the kids are there for nonviolent offenses. And when you look at their first offense, it's often very minor. You know, truancy, running away, maybe stealing something from the corner store, maybe a marijuana charge. So we're really not talking about what to do about super predators. To answer the second part of your question, when I met Curtis, he was 16. He had been told he would serve 2 years, but because of these fights, he ended up spending 6, the years between 10 and 16 behind bars. But he was, I suppose he's the kind of kid that you'd call a poster child. He was literally a choir boy when I met him. He had a beautiful voice and was traveling the state with his church choir. You know, and I suppose that skewed my book a bit because it was harder to access the great majority of kids who did wind up back in juvenile prison and then ultimately in adult prison. So I probably talked to more who had somehow managed to avoid that route than a sociologist would have. But there's no question that he and many others talked about the psychological scars of that period and how those were as difficult to overcome as the sort of more practical barriers, like enrolling in school, finding housing, finding employment with a record.
Right. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nell Bernstein about her blazing exposé of the juvenile justice system. It's called Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Burning Down the House, what's the reference there?
Well, it's a reference to a Talking Heads song, which probably dates me. It just sort of came to my head. I think the subtitle of the book is maybe a little more explanatory, The End of Juvenile Prison. But again, that's aspirational. It's not something I'm describing, although there has been a significant drop, about a 40% drop in the number of kids who are incarcerated, which is very promising. But, I think I went in thinking the book would be more similar to my last book, All Alone in the World, which looks at children of incarcerated parents and has a chapter at the end with a series of recommendations for what we should do or could do to mitigate the trauma of having a parent arrested. But when I got deeper into my research, not only interviewing more kids than I can count and revisiting the kids I had known for years and years, but also reading the research and realizing that we had been trying to reform these institutions, you know, from the very first ribbon cutting of the first House of Refuge in the 1800s, before there even was a juvenile court. We'd been going through this scandal of sort of the rehabilitative promise, the scandal and expose, the investigation, the reform effort, and repeat. And realizing that was also part of what made me title the book the way that I did. The evidence is so powerful, not only that we have repeatedly failed to reform these institutions, but that they're, I think, intrinsically beyond reform, that we really just don't need them.
Right, and we will get back to that a little bit later. First, and I'm also going to get back to solitary confinement, but first I'd like to kind of get to some of those more general facts. You point out that we spend something like 8 times as much money on incarceration versus education. Talk about the costs of incarceration, both short-term and long-term.
Right, and I'm glad that you added that last part, because on average it costs about $88,000 a year to incarcerate a young person versus on average about $10,000 to educate him. In California, where I live, the cost per year got up to $225,000 a year, partly because of multiple lawsuits. And I don't think coincidentally our education spending dropped to $8,000 and something. So, you know, sometimes I call incarceration the last standing entitlement, because it seems that it's the one thing that we will spend anything on. On the other hand, There's I think, possibly a silver lining to that one. You asked about the long-term costs, and those are almost incalculable, but those who've done cost-benefit analyses have found that it can cost $3 million in repeat incarcerations, lost opportunity, lost taxes, that kind of thing, to incarcerate a single juvenile. And I think the reason that we've seen a 40% drop in the number of kids who are locked up over the past decade is that same problem. You know, the states ran into severe budget crises during the recession, and this previously untouchable line item suddenly started to look like maybe something that needed to be addressed. So I think that there's a bright side to that. The problem is that unless those cuts are sort of combined with an understanding that this is ineffective, works to the detriment of public safety, and hurts kids, you know, at some point the economy is going to turn around. And then the phrase, if you build it, they will come, becomes relevant again.
So you're saying, you know, it's maybe a fortunate byproduct of the Great Recession that many of these facilities are closing down, and the emphasis is therefore on a more community-based approach, or at least should be, but that's not, the pendulum will swing back if we don't examine the profound moral as well as, well, the profound moral implications of what we're doing to kids. And so many of them, I mean, you have a statistic that just knocked my socks off. 1 in 3 American school children will be arrested by age 23?
Right. That's the prediction. So that's kind of the, I suppose, the shallow end, but that's the number of kids who will, you know, at some point have handcuffs on them. And the truth is, even if those young people don't wind up behind bars at all or for an extended period of time, if we're arresting 1 in 3, you know, we really are arresting them for sometimes sassing a teacher or drawing on their desk or bringing Advil to school. You know, these sort of seemingly extreme stories that you hear are increasingly common. In fact, one thing I was really surprised to hear during my travels was that typically it's been assumed that juvenile crime goes up in the summer because kids are, you know, on their own with nothing to do, and that's based on, you know, the previous reality that juvenile arrests went up in the summer. Now, juvenile arrests go down in the summer, and that's because the police aren't getting so many calls from the schools to deal with things that would previously have been dealt with by the principal or the counselor.
Wow.
So I think that's pretty telling.
Right. And what about the phenomenon of treating so many children as adults in the criminal justice system? I mean, many of them are just bypassing juvenile prison entirely.
That's also a real concern. I was worried that as we closed the juvenile facilities, especially here in California, where we've gone from having over 10,000 kids to a few hundred in our state juvenile facilities, we would see an uptick in the number of kids tried and sentenced as adults. My understanding is that so far that hasn't happened, and that's great, but there still are laws in place that were passed during the super predator years that are sending far too many kids to adult prison, even as brain development research is showing us that they aren't the same person, even physically, as adults who they are as teenagers. So the 40-year-old who's serving time for something that she did at 15 has a completely different brain structure. But we're still doing it. You know, and the irony is that one of the reasons that we don't need state juvenile facilities is that the more serious offenders are going to adult prison. And that's also, I think, led to an inflationary effect. When you look at who's sent it, the state prisons sort of, again, have an intrinsic need to fill themselves. And as the more serious offenders got transferred to adult court, their place was taken by less serious offenders in the juvenile prisons.
And those juvenile prisons are in very many ways seem to model themselves on the adult prisons in any case. You talk about not having enough food, about education to which they are constitutionally by law are entitled, can consist of a workbook shoved underneath a door and not even checked. We don't have enough time probably in the whole day to go through all the torment, the torture, the punishment, the dehumanization that is just rife. It's just the way of life in these facilities. And we're talking about coming from the guards, not coming from other prisoners.
I mean, honestly, I've heard kids talk about, say you're 19 years old and you're in a juvenile facility, getting in a fight or attacking a guard in order to get transferred to adult prison because they find that the conditions are actually worse inside the juvenile facilities. And there are a number of reasons for that. As you said, we don't have much time. But to begin with, because the premise, again, of the juvenile court is that it's benevolent and rehabilitative, kids don't have the same constitutional rights as adults. So that's kind of the first place that they experience worse treatment. They actually often get longer sentences than adults for the same offense because the institution itself may have discretion over how long they keep them, as in Curtis's case. And then, you know, finally, as I said at the beginning, the reason I use the phrase youth prison is because once you've been inside one of these places, there's just nothing else to call it. They have razor wire, they have a sally port, the clanging gates, and the small cells with a concrete bunk and a metal toilet, which I was told over and over again not to call cells, but to call rooms. You know, they just really are very similar to prisons, and in some cases, even more regimented and strict.
Nell Bernstein. Her book is Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. We'll talk more after the break.
How I got over. How did I make it over? You know my soul back in wonder. How did I make it over? How I made it over. Coming on over all these years. You know my soul. Back and wonder, how did I make it over? Tell me how we got over, Lord. Had a mighty hard time coming out over. You know my soul, look back and wonder, how did we make it over?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Nell Bernstein about juvenile prisons and the terrible injustices they perpetrate on American youth, especially on young people of color. These include sexual and physical abuse, denial of adequate food, and of health care and education.
So you have some chapters in which you go one by one into some of the different ways in which these prisons are even worse than adult prison, how the children's rights, human rights, constitutional rights are being violated. Sexual abuse is probably the first thing that comes to mind in the minds of many, because it's really an open secret that it's rampant in these institutions. But I don't think it's much thought that it's coming from the guards. So tell us a story from one of the stories in the book about sexual abuse and the impact and on the kids. What happens? Yeah. What's the situation with sexual abuse?
So broadly, according to federal studies, which probably don't show the full extent of the problem, 12% of juveniles will be sexually assaulted or abused behind bars. But as you said, what we don't know, or the public doesn't understand, is that 10% of kids are assaulted by guards, whereas 2% are assaulted by other wards. So the don't drop the soap jokes are really kind of missing the point. You know, girls would talk about if you're pregnant in prison, you have to wear a pink uniform. And they would describe seeing a girl turn up in pink after a couple of years and be left to draw their own conclusions. The story I think that really brought home for me not just how devastating this is for girls and boys, but the level of impunity that the guards face was not based on one of my own interviews. It was in a report, I think, from Human Rights Watch that had the testimony from a young woman who was locked up because she had been on her own and had become involved with the sex trade and was given a quote-unquote counselor, a.k.a. guard, who first made her describe to him in meticulous detail what she had done with other men, and then forced her to do those things to and with him. And the real heartbreak of that story is she describes being assaulted in his office, and another staff member opens the door. And, you know, you think that's going to be the moment of rescue, right, an expose. And he just sort of says, excuse me, sorry, as if he were embarrassed to have walked in on, you know, a man and his secretary, and closes the door and walks away. And that's when she realized she really was on her own, that the consequences for what he was doing to her bore no relationship to the consequences that she faced for, you know, something that many of us wouldn't even consider a crime or a crime of survival.
And the irony that, for example, you point out that some kids will land in prison because they had consenting sex with another underage minor. And then, you know, say at the age of 13, and then they are sent to prison and labeled as a sex offender for the rest of their life, whereas the abuse coming, the rape coming from the guards is just treated with absolute impunity.
Yeah, I visited a sex offenders unit in California, and I remember one kid there who had turned 18 saying that he walked on eggshells every day because, you know, I think he was in a similar situation to the one you described in terms of his offense, but he was locked up in, I believe, a dormitory situation with 14-year-old boys. And he said, you know, I look at somebody wrong or they decide that they want to get me, and there goes the rest of my life. A lot of kids feel set up, and whether or not they're being intentionally set up, there's sort of no arguing with their perspective when you look at the situation that they're in.
And then there's also the, you know, that's the prison culture, let's say, non-official. But there's the official prison culture, which I think could be safely described as a continual rape situation, where you have kids getting cavity searches, you know, as you point out, when they've been visiting the doctor and they've been, in chains the whole time, brought to the bus and then into the doctor's office and then back to the bus, and then they have to get a cavity search.
You're right. There are the abuses, and then there are the daily traumas. And a lot of kids have already been traumatized in many ways when they walk in the doors. And for the girls, prior sexual abuse is very common. So when you talk about things like strip searches and pat downs, they are often re-traumatizing, whether or not the guards push it or harass them as they do it. And a strip search isn't what we think. A pregnant girl describes having to crouch and cough, lift her breasts. You know, it's very invasive. And it happens all the time. I mean, I remember once I went to teach a writing workshop inside a juvenile hall and didn't know that I was supposed to count the pencils before I handed them out, so that I could count them again to make sure that no one had taken one. And because I made that error, every kid who'd been in my class had to be strip searched. And I thought about that. I mean, I was driving home. I was the one who blew it, but they were the ones who were paying the price. And that's one of many incidents that brought home to me the way that these kids feel really like they're paying not so much for what they've done, but for who they are. And in terms of whatever the effect of incarceration is supposed to be, that works exactly against it.
And who they are is overwhelmingly kids of color and poor.
That's right. And, I mean, the racial disparities are tremendous. A black kid is nearly 5 times as likely to be incarcerated for the same offense under the same circumstances as a white kid. And those disparities get more extreme the deeper you go into the system. But, you know, even if you happen to be a white middle-class kid, once you put on that uniform, you are nothing but a prisoner. You know, you're given a number instead of a name. Your clothes are taken and replaced by a uniform. Your belongings are replaced by this barren cell. And, you know, you're told when to brush your teeth and for how long. So I think that that's also what I meant, who they are as prisoners, as well as who they are, having brought them to that status.
Right. So now back to solitary confinement, because you tell, I think, a story which is really searing. It's a story of Eliza, a very promising young woman who had overcome just incredible abuse and neglect in her childhood, or was about to overcome it, and then something happened. Tell us about her, who she was, what was she like, and then what happened to her?
Yeah, I mean, she was one of the kids who really broke my heart. She, I don't think, was any older than 14 when she came to us and had been on her own mostly since 11, when the state had decided that her very loving great-grandmother was too old to take care of her. And between 11 and 14, she went through what she thinks is probably as many as 40 foster homes and group homes, and ultimately decided she would do better on her own, and did quite well on her own. You know, she enrolled herself in school, she got a job, she wasn't doing great, but she was doing better. She got through those years with a couple of stints in juvenile hall for running from the group homes, and as soon as she turned 18 and believed herself free from being essentially criminalized for surviving, she enrolled in college, which she had always dreamed of. And I remember the call I got from her the day she registered. She had the course catalog, and she was reading it, you know, as if it were her Christmas wish list. She was so excited. She called again a few days later and said that she'd been into the financial aid office, and they had told her that she had an outstanding warrant for having run from a group home at some point, and that until she cleared that, she would be ineligible for financial aid, which in her situation would make in college impossible. So to clear the warrant, she was required to serve 3 days in county jail, which you would think she could survive, and she certainly thought that too. But Eliza, you know, I sometimes describe her as having a face that launched 1,000 fights. She had this very intense manner about her. She didn't take anything from anyone, and pretty soon, in this triple-capacity, overcrowded dormitory, she was involved in a fight. And my understanding was that it was difficult for the guards to break up the fight. She had been through so much that once that anger was unleashed, it was very hard to contain. So what they did was strip her naked and toss her into what's known as a cold cell, which is what it sounds like. It's an empty room with tiled walls and nothing in it but a drain in the floor. It's used in county jails technically for psychotic prisoners who are a danger to others and themselves. It's also used by the CIA to try to break terrorism suspects. And that was the effect it had on Eliza. She couldn't stop screaming, and they kept telling her, stop screaming and we'll let you out, but she couldn't. So eventually, after what she thinks was several days, they sedated her, and she stopped screaming, and they let her out. But I don't think it's a cliche to say that she was never the same. The next time I saw her, she just didn't have that energy, and she was sort of blank-eyed, and she told me that after she turned 18, she had requisitioned her child welfare file, which you're allowed to do, and learned that when she was an infant, there had been times when her mother would go out to score, and child welfare workers had found her alone, naked, filthy, starving in her crib, where they believed she had sometimes been left for days. And she felt as if in the cold cell, she literally regressed to that infantile state of helpless captivity, deprivation, unheard cries. And that reawakening of that profound trauma was something she really never got over. She didn't go to college. I don't want to go into too much detail, but she's not doing well. It was a real heartbreak.
Yeah, that is the word for it. And we're talking with Nell Bernstein. Her book is Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. It's a terrific book, and I highly recommend it to all our listeners. Now, we mentioned the word reform in the beginning, and you have already broached the idea that, you know, we need to go beyond reform. But there has been a movement toward reform of this brutal system, and we've only skimmed the surface. We haven't talked about the physical abuse. We haven't talked about, you know, the whole-scale abandonment of kids when they get out of prison, and their inability to find jobs, and how they're just basically funneled right back into them. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of the scandals that led to some of the reforms that are now happening.
You know, it's hard to know where to begin. I think one thing that helped was the introduction of surveillance cameras into these facilities, because now we have videotapes of guards setting dogs on unresisting boys, as well as a large library of videos of guards just beating kids up. There was an extremely widespread sex scandal in the Texas facilities that led to an overhaul of the whole system. It's almost hard to count the scandals. You know, the one that I think really clinched it for me in terms of this notion that the real recidivist is the system itself was a place called the Dozier School for Boys in Florida, where a group of middle-aged men who'd been there as young boys came together and began to draw attention to what they had suffered there in a little outbuilding called the White House. They talked about beatings for things like smirking that were so severe that there was bits of flesh on the walls of the building. They talked about going with a friend and coming back without him and not knowing what had happened to him. So that led to an investigation and an expose, and they closed the White House and put a plaque on it. Well, it later came out that even as they were having this ceremony of repentance, boys locked up in that facility were not allowed on the yard that day because, as one of them told a reporter, they were afraid we would tell the truth. Even after they closed the place in 2011 and began digging up the bodies behind the building, which is something that's still in progress, the kids who transferred went on to report severe abuses at the facilities to which they were transferred. But what really got me when I began to look into Dozier was the fact that it had gone through this cycle of scandal, investigation, revelation, reform at least a dozen times since its inception. And the first outraged report of what was going on there was dated 1908.
Wow.
So that really, I think, is an indicator of, you know, why these places are so hard to reform. And I haven't entirely answered that question for myself, but I think what it comes down to is when you put walls around something, it not only keeps people inside, it keeps the rest of us outside. And that includes, to a degree, the media. You know, there's some pretty tight controls over what you can and can't see inside these places. And that, in turn, creates a kind of impunity that breeds abuse. And then you add to that not only the intrinsic power differential between a guard and a prisoner, but the differential between an adult and a child. And you really have a recipe for abuse.
It reminds me of the Stanley Milgram experiments, those experiments where, you know, people were put in the position of being prisoners and guards. And the guards became so brutal, and these were normal college kids. And the guards became so brutal within just a few days that the experiment had to be terminated.
That's right. And I think among many lessons of that experiment, one that I gleaned from it is that it's important not to demonize the individual guards. I mean, first of all, I met some who, you know, had dedicated their lives to these kids and basically spent their lives in prisons and were not abusing the kids in their custody, as far as I knew. But even those who do, if you think about the fact that, as you said, Stanford students found themselves abusing their power within a matter of days, again, I think we have to understand that the problem is intrinsic to this system and not a matter of a few bad apples, and can't be solved by firing a few individuals, although certainly holding guards to the same level of accountability that we do children would be a good thing it actually wouldn't solve the problem.
So what would solve the problem? What do we need to do to have true rehabilitation, and how can we get from here to there?
Well, you know, the easy answer is nothing. And here's why I say that. If 80 to 90% of us go through a period of delinquency and grow out of it, that tells us that there is a proportion of quote-unquote delinquents who, if we just left them alone, would in fact grow out of it. There are also kids who are dealing with very difficult situations at home and in their neighborhoods, and those situations as well as their actions need to be addressed. But we know how to do that effectively. There are three programs that are known collectively as the evidence-based interactions or interventions, the evidence-based interventions, because they've been extensively studied, multisystemic therapy, functional family therapy, et cetera. And they all involve allowing a young person to remain in his own home, surrounding that young person with very individualized services and supports, including a caseworker who carries a very small caseload and is sometimes available around the clock, not only to the child, but, and I think this is key, to his family. Because if family issues are a part of what is leading to the delinquency, if you lock a kid up for a year or two and send him back to the same situation without having done anything to remedy it, the results are pretty predictable. I think the other thing that we need to think about is justice reinvestment, which essentially means not only shutting down these facilities, which is essential, but taking some of the money, or even all of it, and investing it in high incarceration communities so that the kids that we're now locking up have the things that my kids have, you know, a park, a community center, a functioning school, some kind of a safety net. These are the things that I think would solve the problem. And I know I've used the word heartbreak a lot, but what really kills me is that we know it. In fact, I think almost every state in the nation has some version of an evidence-based program, but it's a pilot, and it serves a small number of kids, whereas this other intervention, incarceration, which has also been extensively studied and found to do harm, both to the kid and in terms of public safety, remains the fallback. So I think if we reversed that equation, we'd be well on our way to solving a problem that is actually not that difficult to solve.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Nell Bernstein, as is your book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. I really hope that this will be widely read, because I think it's an extremely important book, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for those very kind words.
Nell Bernstein's book is Burning Down the House. You can read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. We have a few minutes left in today's show, just enough time to air some clips from a conversation I had recently with poet Kathy Engel about her efforts to use poetry to bring Jews and Palestinians together, as well as introducing Americans to the voices of Palestinian poets. Engel has founded, co-founded, and directed social justice and human rights organizations using the creative imagination and art to promote peace and justice. She's the author most recently of Ruth's Skirts and co-editor with Kamal Bulata of We Begin Here, Poems for Palestine and Lebanon, out from Interlink Books. When I spoke with her several weeks ago, she was in the midst of organizing a reading of Palestinian and Israeli poetry on the East End of Long Island. It's not the first such event Engel has organized.
Beginning in 1982 with the poet June Jordan, who is no longer with us, and the poet Sarah Miles,
and the Palestinian artist Kamal Bulata in 82, following the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, we still, again, then, before, were kind of struggling with what can we do that's useful, that is true to us and what we have to offer, and that open spaces. So we created something called Moving Towards Home, which was a poetry reading, and then of Palestinian, Lebanese, Israeli, and American poets supporting children in Lebanon through UNICEF. And it was co-sponsored by the Penn American Center. And then a book came out of that and other readings. And 20 years later, in 2006, when another invasion, Kamal Bulata and I found each other across continents. He's living in the south of France, and we brought back that book and added to it, and Interlink Books put out We Begin Here, Poems for Palestine and Lebanon, which we co-edited, came out in 2007, and different communities hosted readings all across the country in those 2 years following. And what we found, and what I've always found, which is why I return to the space of poems, even though I stand vigil and work with different organizations for peace and justice, is that the poems provided a space for people to talk, to question, to share, to cry, to struggle. That's a difficult space to get at when it's such a charged, historically charged question. At the least, my interest is to contribute to breaking the silence and the stigma and the denial in relation to the reality of the Palestinian people, and through the voice of poetry.
I sense a hesitation in your voice as you talk about this. Why that hesitation?
Oh, my God. I mean, there is tremendous ongoing resistance and antagonism to acknowledging, naming, and recognizing. I mean, just to say, support the people of Gaza, the hesitation comes from a lot of experience.
Engel feels it's important for Jews like herself to speak out on the Palestinians' behalf.
I do feel that because the way the narrative has been constructed, there has been a inaccurate and really problematic equation between criticizing Israel and anti-Semitism, and it's very dangerous. Israel can't be treated exceptionally. The policies are unacceptable in terms of the sovereignty and the human rights of the Palestinian people, and I think that people have been silenced because of the way this narrative has developed and how powerful and silencing and threatening it's been. I think it is important for American Jews to speak out.
Kathy Engel. Among her books is We Begin Here, Poems for Palestine and Lebanon, which she co-edited with Kamal Bulata. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.